Welcome to the Vancouver Tech Podcast. My name is James.
And I'm Drew.
How's it going, Drew?
Awesome. How you doing, James?
Good, good. I had a very exciting week.
Yeah, you sure did. Yeah. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, so I got a new job.
You did?
Yeah.
Wow, that's out of the blue. So you're now working for someone?
Yes, I'm working at Invoke Media.
Invoke Media, cool. What does Invoke do?
Yeah, so Invoke partners with different companies to build products. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that they're sort of known for is Hootsuite.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple other that they've done. There's one that they just released called Control.
Yep.
And so they're one of the things that they do, among the many things, is they will partner with different companies to build their product
mm-hmm.
and then help them actually move that product into the actual, into their house, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like, we build it in-house at Invoke, and it slowly gets moved over, and we help them transition from relying on an external vendor
yep.
to actually moving it into their team. So Invoke has gone from like teams of 40 people building this product for a company that's hired them
mm-hmm.
to a team of, you know, once that product gets rolled out, mm-hmm. those people can actually become part of that team, which is like really appealing for someone like me because I wanted to work on a product, mm-hmm. but I didn't want it to be just the same product every day. And so this is like the perfect fit for me. So I'm really happy to be there.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. So what kind of stuff are you working on?
I'm actually in charge of a product right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I can say the details. I'll have to double check. I have to be a little bit more careful about the things that I talk about now. So I'll have to get the rundown about what I can actually say.
Right.
But it's an application for helping contractors get quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in charge of this new product, and it'll probably last maybe 6 months or close to a year maybe by the time you're actually transitioning it to their team,
mm-hmm.
the actual person that's hiring Invoke when we transition it to their team.
Yep.
So there could be this their two-phased approach, build it and then help them move it to their internal team.
Interesting.
Pretty cool.
So this sounds like a greenfield project.
Yeah, it's brand new, fresh, nothing to build on.
That's pretty cool. So you said you're in charge of it. So does that mean you get say in the tech stack as
yes.
well?
Yes. So I'm sort of handling the technical side. I do have a boss now who's the head of technical, Wes.
Oh, okay.
And he's got like so much experience. He's been in Invoke for a long time. He's seen a lot of these products come in and then eventually go to market.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I'm in charge of the implementation side,
yep.
but it's always based around what Wes knows about the product because mm-hmm. I haven't had any direct contact with the client.
Right.
So we need to make sure that it fits with the actual That's business case
mm-hmm.
as well as the technical side of maybe what happens if someone else comes in and takes this over?
Right.
Are we choosing something that's like a niche technology that's going to be really hard to hire for?
Yeah.
Or are we choosing something that's very generalized that we can find anywhere? Or
so what kind of stuff are you actually choosing?
So I think this one will be in PHP for mm-hmm. it's a very cruddy app.
Mm-hmm.
There is some API stuff, so it's possible that there could be some little services eventually. Also, it's using a lot of AWS stuff so that it can scale eventually,
mm-hmm.
and it'll be a lot easier to move it over to someone else because we create everything in their account,
mm-hmm.
and then by doing that, it lets us move it over a lot easier. So it actually helps the transition because there's no like, okay, give me those keys, and oh yeah, we got to move the app, and oh, we got to migrate the database and seed it, and blah, blah, blah. You don't even worry about that. You basically just point to DNS and make sure that it's all set up, and the AWS docs are there if you mm-hmm. need to make changes or change the account information.
Right.
So all that's there as well. So it's nice having a big team to support you on the technical side, planning side, management side,
mm-hmm.
content side, marketing side, design side. I didn't really have that before because
right.
my team was so small.
Uh-huh.
But now it's a lot bigger, and there's all these people that have a lot more experience for these bigger projects.
So how many
really
people
helpful.
Will be working on this project with you?
Probably like 6, maybe 7, mm-hmm. I think, floating around. So this mm-hmm. isn't the only project that these other people have, but
right.
for the moment, it's the only one I have.
Mm-hmm.
I literally started like 4 days ago. So yeah, it's been a quick intro to getting started.
Interesting. That sounds pretty cool. What about for, so you said PHP, I guess that's powering the back end. What about mm-hmm. for front end?
Front end, it's it could be something more fancy like React or
mm-hmm.
whatever. It sort of depends. I think I need to find out what the longer term goal is.
Yeah.
There might be, so for something like this, it's possible they could build a native app. So
mm-hmm.
We talked to the guy from Mobify. Mm-hmm. What was his name? Guy.
Oh, right. Eric.
Yeah, Eric.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Muser. Yeah, so we talked to Eric about React Native and building it. The web one was the exact same as the native one,
mm-hmm.
the native quote-unquote one. So maybe that would be a good choice. If they plan on building a native app, they could reuse a lot of that code.
It's kind of interesting. We had a similar discussion at work last week, and it was neat. Like, I thought, you know, we have a web front end. We have an currently an iPhone app and we're looking at an Android app. Mm-hmm. And I brought up the idea of, you know, would it be interesting to take a look at React and mm-hmm. say, you know, maybe we have this kind of similar framework. Although I guess React for front end and React Native are going to be different.
Yeah.
But we might be able to have people that are cross team and going from, you know, the web app to the mobile app. And we had like some pretty good conversation around it, I thought. And one of the things that we thought made sense to look at and evaluate is what does the code actually look like? Does it look like it belongs in this environment? Like if you've ever, say, you're used to writing Go or Java and you start writing Ruby, your Ruby might look a lot different from what a Rubyist's Ruby might look like. Or, you know, if I've been used to writing Ruby and I start writing PHP, I don't know what the conventions are these days, but it might look quite different and it might just feel different.
Right.
And so we're like, you know, we want code that looks like it belongs in the environment where it's at. So
right.
that, you know, if you're looking at Objective-C, it looks like Objective-C. If you're looking at Java, it looks like Java.
Following convention.
That's kind of interesting. Yeah. Why use this framework? So of course you have like maybe speed of iteration, and you have, I don't know, I'm not that familiar with React to be honest. So there may be some really good things that I'm missing or overlooking here. But we kind of thought like, oh, you know, there's this other part to look at as well. What does the code base actually look like?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean, I use, I found this thing for PHP that will actually lint my code for formatting.
Mm-hmm.
So it says like, don't put for methods on classes, put braces on new lines.
Right.
Oh, okay. If I keep following that rule, like I don't do that in my JavaScript,
right.
but I do it in my PHP because it's part of PSR2, the PHP standard recommendation number 2, which says like, okay, use 4 spaces instead of tabs and 2 tabs.
Yeah.
And some people see it as like silly, but the thing is like if everyone has these linting tools turned on or these like formatting tools, then it's always the same. And you never have to go in and be like, okay, like why did this person do this? And even with JavaScript, if you have linting tools, it says like, don't make functions in a loop, which some people do, but if they don't have tools on that tell them not to do that, then, I mean, there might not be anything inherently bad about it. You kind of have to sometimes, but
that's,
I mean,
actually something, you know, I really like about Go is that you can't put that, like when you're doing a function declaration, you can't put that curly brace on a new line. You have to put it in line. And it's just that decision is just made.
Yeah.
You don't have to have that conversation.
If you upload like raw Go files, people be like, run Go format on that. So it actually formats it. So if you just have like a paste of a Go code, like, you should be formatting that.
It's kind of interesting because for me, I do prefer like 2 spaces and whatever. But because I'm using the Go formatting, I can see that in my editor. Mm-hmm. And when I save it, it saves to proper Go.
Yeah,
it
automatically formats.
Yeah,
so nice.
It's awesome.
I use 2 spaces in my JavaScript, but 4 spaces in PHP.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, you know, I just kind of use what I'm used to and what I think everyone else uses. Mm-hmm. I haven't really seen 4 spaces in JavaScript that much.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of follow, like, I'll change it if someone has a good reason. I don't really, not that crazy about it. Do you watch Silicon Valley?
No, actually I don't.
Oh man, they had this argument about tabs and spaces and stuff like that. So it was really funny.
That is kind of funny, yeah.
Guy like dumped his girlfriend over it.
Awesome. Yeah. So want to hop into the meetups around town.
All right. So not a crazy week, but it's pretty packed nonetheless.
Yeah, it was. It was pretty interesting. So what were the meetups that you went to, James?
Yeah, so I actually went to the PHP meetup.
Oh, you did? What was that all about?
It was all about Intro to Symfony, Life After ORM, and Introduction to Dependency Injection.
Oh, wow. That sounds really interesting. So
very PHP specific.
Well, maybe. What's the Life After ORM? What was that like?
It was about, I guess that one isn't that specific. It was from Anthony, this guy Anthony. It was his first talk at the PHP meetup. He talked about why or why not to choose an ORM.
Yep.
And he was really not like, you'd think that's a very polarizing topic, but he was sort of like, I don't care. I just kind of use one based on what I need to do.
Right.
Like a lot of people, he showed like some code on the left, some code on the right, 2 panes.
Uh-huh.
And he showed the SQL version of the ORM thing, which was like maybe fetching a relationship in a single attribute or a single column.
Mm-hmm.
And like the code on the left is like way bigger because you need to like handle the relationship, get it, join it, put them together, then query it, and then maybe limit it or whatever, or sort it.
Right.
Like the query gets a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
In PHP, there's this thing called fluency, which is basically if you have a class, you return the class itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you can start chaining methods, same as JavaScript.
Yep.
So you can have these things where it's like, get this thing, then do this, then do this, then do this.
What are the ORM, like the main ORM choices in the PHP community?
There's Doctrine, Pimple, I think there's one other big one, but I can't remember the name. I think it also starts with a P.
Mm-hmm.
And then Eloquent is the one that is in Laravel, which is a big one as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Is that the one that he was showing?
He wasn't really subscribed to any specific one. They also all look really similar.
Oh, okay.
Like when you're just doing a general query,
yep,
you're basically using a class as a map to the database, right? Mm-hmm. So they all look really similar. There might be some like language changes, like instead of order by, someone might just say order,
mm-hmm,
or like sort or something like that. But they generally all look really similar. It's just how they work behind the scenes that's really different.
Right.
But I don't know about you, but like I like the ORM because it just makes me way faster. I make less mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't need to worry about validating or escaping my queries. I have written raw queries because I just needed to,
because
I wanted to like sort things by certain columns before I got the results, or I wanted to use a result set that's sorted before I apply it to another result set,
mm-hmm,
which is not really something you can do in an ORM. But I don't know about yourself, what you think, but I'm like, I'll write them when I need to and use them when I don't. So
yeah, I think it kind of depends. I'm usually of the opinion that I want to build something out as minimal as possible before I make any choices. And like, hopefully it totally depends, right? Because
yeah,
a lot of the time you might be working on something and like, boom, here, you've got this stack already. If it has an ORM, you're using it. Right?
Yeah. Guess what? You're using an ORM now.
But if you're building out a greenfield project, then I'd like to do some of the queries myself first and then kind of see what this looks like and see where things are and be like, oh, okay, you know what? This is actually becoming really cumbersome and maybe we need an ORM here, maybe a light one, or maybe something like Active Record.
Yeah. One thing everyone agreed on was if you're using an ORM, it becomes much easier to change your database backend if that becomes a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So like for myself, I run my SQ, my tests will run in an SQLite memory database, whereas my actual program runs in a MariaDB database. So there are some differences between SQLite and MariaDB or MySQL in terms of like nullable columns and stuff like that. But the ORM actually takes care of that behind the scenes. I don't have to worry about having alternate migrations for running those tests,
right?
Because it just, the ORM knows, oh, you're using SQLite, make sure this query is adjusted in such a way. You need to know about that. It's important to know. But as long as you know what the ORM is doing, then I think you're okay. Because I run my tests and it takes me, you know, my speed is way faster. If there's something wrong with the test, then it's like there's something wrong with the core, which is like a bigger problem. But I found it so much easier just to switch between databases, like without even thinking about it, just toggling some environment variables, bam, everything's different.
That's a pretty good point. But I mean, like, how often are you going to be changing databases?
Yeah, I thought about that too. Like, it might become like a problem once hopefully you don't switch your database like every other week.
You'd have to have a pretty compelling reason to, I think.
But I think a lot of people can go from like MySQL to Postgres. Like, that might be a change that they make for maybe like scalability or JSON or whatever the nice things that Postgres
I could see, like, especially if you were writing your own queries, I could see a lot of stuff break.
Yeah,
if you're going from MySQL switching to
Postgres.
Like,
so hopefully you have some idea, or hopefully you think about it when you're writing those queries.
Yeah.
Like, oh, is this going to work in Postgres, or is this going to work in SQLite?
Yeah.
But
so the other one, actually two other talks there, but one that I think sounds quite interesting. You said introduction to dependency injection.
Yeah.
So what was that all about?
So there's the guy, Sean, I think he'll do another talk too, but he actually runs the LaraChat group, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
A huge group, massive Slack channel. But he was talking about why you'd use dependency injection over like instantiation inside of the class.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big things was like testing, or even just throwing exceptions when the arguments are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So if you might use an interface, you might detect an interface when you're injecting versus detecting a class itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have something like a connection interface, and a connection could be there's a MySQL connection and an SQLite connection and a Postgres connection.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be type hinting or detecting to see, is this an implementation of the connection interface? Or is it an implementation of the connection class and something's extending it?
Mm-hmm.
You don't really have that ability inside of when you're actually grabbing the element or building the class inside of the constructor versus injecting it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're building it inside, what happens is like, how do you know that the method is going to be there if somebody injects some class?
Right.
Or somebody just instantiates a class and it depends on another class in a locked kind of way? You might not know that the method is there, but if you use an interface, the class would throw errors before you even got to that step because it didn't implement the interface properly.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely something like that where it makes your code a little bit more self-detecting in terms of errors.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, you passed the wrong thing. You can't pass that because everything else is going to fail instead of passing it and it failing later.
So that's actually really interesting because you're like, oh, really PHP heavy topics. And I was like, well, especially after hearing this explanation, those two in particular, they don't sound necessarily tied into PHP.
Right.
Sure, the examples were probably given PHP, but I think like the last time I went to the PHP meetup, I got a lot out of it, even though I'm not writing PHP, and I don't really plan to. Not that I have anything particularly against PHP, but
it's not in the stack.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, we do actually have a PHP service. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think it sounds like those would be great talks to go to.
Yeah, it was fun. Sounds what like about yourself? What'd you
so
go to?
So for me, I went to Warcraft, the movie.
Oh, yeah. My girlfriend went to that, too.
Nice. Yeah.
When she wasn't that impressed.
Really?
Yeah, she went last night.
Oh, I don't like her now. I'm just kidding. I really liked it. I've heard some people say some bad things about it. I guess my one complaint is that it wasn't 2 or 3 hours longer.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So what was it? What did you think was she like? She's in a compositing course at VFS, at Vancouver Film School. So she went to see the insane graphics.
Yeah,
because they are insane, and the facial expressions and stuff. Just watching the trailer, like this is crazy. This is like next level stuff.
Yeah,
like how detailed it is, how insane it looks.
Uh-huh.
She just said that she didn't like the mix of live action and digital. She said
mix I mean, there was.
Tough.
I think that's still like, it's still pretty. No, I don't want to say like too early days, but like, you know, like old school Sinbad or something, and you see like this Cyclops that
it's like stop motion.
Sure, like
or something.
We've never really gotten perfect.
Yeah.
Right. And we still haven't. But as far as like getting close, I think it was there.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I'm a huge WoW fan.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I played the game since 2004.
Oh yeah. Are you still playing now?
I am just a little bit, but
yeah. So she played the game as well. And she went with friends that played the game too, and she said that acting choices were she didn't like, and she didn't like the storyline as much. There was like some romantic thing that she didn't really make sense.
There was, I mean, I think there was definitely the, you know, trying to tell too much of a story in too little of a time, I think, sort of element to it.
Right.
But having said that, I was just so excited.
Yeah.
And so like, so happy that they actually made this into a movie.
Hasn't it been like
I think
5
awesome.
Or 8 years in
ten,
the making?
Ten years 10? In the making.
Damn. Yeah. So it's been a little long overdue.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm a believer. I think it was awesome.
Cool.
And so, that's all I went to actually last week.
Sure.
All right. So this week on Monday, we've got a pretty awesome lineup there. What do we have? Mm-hmm.
We have GitHub and Zero Tech.
And that is it 4 p.m. To 6 p.m.?
Yes.
And it's at, over at Decentral, 436 West Pender. I hope to see you there. We also have this Vancouver Technology Leaders. Now, I put this in here because it had technology in it.
Right.
I'm not really sure how interesting of a meetup it is. In fact, it says, you know, the location's only shown to members. It's at 6 p.m.
Mm.
And I didn't bother signing up because I'm not personally very interested in going. But what do you think? Are you going to go to this?
Yeah, I don't know. You're talking about the Cybersecurity Roundtable lunch, right? Monday, July 11th.
Yes.
Yeah, so that one's actually at 12.
Oh, it is. Too.
Yeah,
yeah.
But it does need a location and all that stuff too. But I mean, maybe it's kind of weird. I'm not sure if this is the description is very, very slim.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to definitely sign up to get a little bit more.
Yeah.
But, so another one that I thought also location only shown to members that I did decide to join the group was the Generate Technology group.
Mm-hmm.
So this is 7 p.m. to 9:15. And this is over at The Edge, 412 289 Alexander Street.
Mm-hmm.
And the Generate Technology group, this one, it looks like it's Predictive Interface Technology Meeting number 2. And this looks pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's it seems like it's about like actual interfaces that can figure out what you want from them, I guess. Which I guess makes sense, called Predictive Interface.
Mm-hmm.
Or is that it's not a company, it's actually a product or an idea.
Yeah, it looks like it's an idea, a predictive interface.
Yeah.
So it looks like it's a pretty interesting sort of meetup around technology and maybe here it looks like kind of between design and development.
If you're searching for this, it's Generate, as in G-E-N-R-8, mm-hmm. the letter 8, or number 8, not the letters.
The letter 8.
Yeah.
And that's our Monday.
Yeah.
So Tuesday, we've got another Lunch and Learn over at Brain Station. And this is from 12 till 1. This is a free lunch and learn.
Yeah.
And it looks like it'll be pretty interesting. Grant Daisley, marketing at Whole Foods Market.
Yeah, I think Whole Foods is probably very good at marketing, considering they're able to sell like really expensive products for, to a certain type of individual.
That's pretty interesting. So now that I read this, marketing at Whole Foods, I'm kind of wondering, like, how much marketing have you seen from Whole Foods? Where's the marketing? It might be really interesting to see how they do their marketing. And as far as I know, Whole Foods is like, I think they do a lot of like organic sort of produce.
One of the things that they really talk about is like the stuff that you buy there is not going to be like processed or unhealthy or there's a, not to get to a controversial topic, but GMO stuff is like that. They're in the area that is probably not for GMOs, but maybe I'm not talking about Whole Foods properly, but it's one of those things where you have those options that are a lot more healthy and just add $5 to whatever you paid at No Frills.
All right. And then we have the Vancouver Rust coming up at 5:30 to 7:30 at the Vancouver Public Library. So this is probably, I think, Tuesdays. I think we're going to switch it back over to Wednesday. We'll work a little better for me, but I'm going to talk with the Rust community and see. We might either switch it to Wednesday or Thursday.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And then we have this Bitcoin meetup from at Decentral, the Ethereum Workshop.
Yeah, that looks pretty interesting. So from 4:30, if you're interested in Ethereum, it looks like this is kind of an intro to Ethereum and smart contracts. So what are the tools and gotchas out there when setting up or writing your own
smart contracts? I had a friend that was on the Ethereum team because he's like a math genius. Yep. I don't know if he's on it anymore, but I'll have to ask him because maybe he's involved in that.
Interesting, And we've got the Closure Hack Night coming up at 6 p.m.
Oh, yeah.
We're at CodeCore, 142 West Hastings.
Bring a computer.
Make sure to,
Then we have the Women in Games Roundtable at Lighthouse Labs, and this is the Women in Games Vancouver meetup.
Yep, and that's Lighthouse Labs, number 300, 128 West Hastings, from 6 to 8. Would you bring a laptop to that?
I think so, although, I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Maybe.
Let us know if you do.
Bring it. If you don't use it, well, I guess you got to work out carrying that laptop around.
All right, and that's our Tuesday. So Wednesday the 15th, we've got the Vancouver Data Visualizations. Mm-hmm. This is at, it says 9:30 a.m. and it needs a location. So I guess if you've got a location, you want to have the Vancouver Data Visualization Group there. Looks like there's 45 so far RSVP'd. Why don't you reach out to them and let them know you've got a location.
Cool. All right, and then we have the Vancouver Linux Desktop Meetup.
Yeah, and this is over at 436 West Pender at Decentral from 4:30 to 6:30.
Yeah.
So if you've got a laptop that you want to get Linux on, or you have Linux, you're using it, you want to help people with Linux, this is your meetup.
Yeah, I actually had a guy at Invoke telling me he wanted to go to this. He just hadn't had time.
Nice. Yeah, it sounds like it'd be pretty cool. I've been thinking about maybe grabbing a Chromebook that doesn't have the French keyboard layout.
Yeah.
And then putting Linux on that.
Yeah, and I think if you get them off Amazon, even the .ca site, they don't come with French. So nice. If you want to order one, that's pretty cool.
Sweet. And then we've got the, not that I have anything against French, I just really dislike the enter key on those keyboards.
Yeah. No. Entrez-vous. Yeah. Cool. And the Vancouver Pluralsight Study Group has a new meetup, the Pluralsight Study Group, the WebGL and 3JS Fundamentals.
Yeah, that looks like it might be pretty interesting. Do you know anything about 3JS?
Yeah, actually, I used it once to prototype a potential project where this guy wanted to do like a clothing store where you could actually change the clothes, like change the colors and stuff. And I was like, oh, you know what? Instead of doing like a million pictures, which is like brutal and really expensive, let's build like a little 3JS app where you can just model the clothes. We get a digital artist, model the clothes once, like model a shirt. Mm-hmm. And then we can actually change the texture, like change the material, but also change the color, because the material, it has something called a map. I can't remember what the exact term is, but the map shows you highlights and shadows.
And that's interesting. So how true to the actual clothing would it be?
You can use actual patterns from actual materials, because like this is like common for digital assets. You just combine them all together and make the thing you want. Like you know, you see a car and there's glass on it, there's rubber on it, and these things look good enough for a movie. Maybe good enough for a site that are shopping for some clothes, right?
Well, certainly good enough for that. But I mean, I wonder if they're actually going to be exactly the same. So I've ordered things online and they've ended up looking, you know, like you see a picture and you're like, wow, I really like the look of this material.
Right.
And you get it. And it's like, this isn't the material that I thought it was.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a problem for everyone, whether you're using a 3D model or a photo.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's
an interesting concept. It was fun and crazy, but it's really, really advanced. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, get into those fundamentals because it can be really overwhelming.
Yeah. Okay. So that sounds pretty cool. And that's over at the Pluralsight Study Group at PNI Digital Media Offices, 100 425 Carroll Street. Bring a laptop. Then there's the .NET Users Group, 555 Seymour Street, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Yeah.
Do you use .NET at all?
I used to do .NET Nuke stuff. Mm-hmm. That was my first job. I was building .NET Nuke themes for .NET Nuke 6, I think, or 5, was fun. So yeah, I haven't used it in a long time.
Interesting.
I never actually wrote any like .NET code.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah.
All right, so that's happening at 6 p.m. the BCIT downtown campus. Would you bring a laptop to that? It looks like it's going to be some speakers, some presentations. So I would say you probably don't have to.
Yeah, I would skip the laptop probably.
Yeah. And Van Swift needs a location. This is happening at 6 p.m. And I think this is going to be a really interesting meetup.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually had Parveen, the organizer, on our show a while back. And he was talking about getting this going. So it looks like it's finally here. The Van Swift meetup. It's going to be awesome. If you got a location for it, reach out to Parveen.
Yeah. Yeah, this one's actually WWDC is this week. And so the meetup is literally in the middle of WWDC. So you can get to chat about what's coming up or what's already passed.
Cool. What is WWDC?
Worldwide Developer Conference. And it's for Apple, of course. Swift and Apple.
I see. So that's why it coincides with that and what's new in Swift 3.0.
Exactly.
Nice. And then Thursday the 16th, we've got our Code and Coffee at 6:30 p.m.
Yeah, one of my favorite meetups, couple of speakers, bit of networking. Check it out.
Yeah. And then before that, we've got the DDD CQRS ES Practitioners. This is over at Decentral, 436 West Pender, from 4:30 to 7. And this is pretty awesome. Have you been going to this?
I went a couple times in a row. Yep. I missed the last one this Thursday.
I guess with your new job, what sort of hours do you have?
Yeah, I'm sort of done around 5-ish, but I think that it might be interesting to get some of the team members there because I've changed the way that I think about things, especially with domain-driven language.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have this new project, and we have an estimate and a quote. Mm-hmm. But they're different things. Those are literally different things. So don't use those words when you mean the other thing.
Right.
Use the appropriate wording. And I think that's really appropriate. And it helps like understand, because I was getting confused when someone was explaining to me the application because they kept using quote and estimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew they were different.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, wait. So who sends a quote? And they're like, oh, the contractor sends a quote based on an estimate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, you kept saying estimate over and over. So that's really important. And I think it's really changed the way I think about how to actually talk about stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And especially, I guess in your case, you're working on a greenfield project.
Yeah.
It'd be great to go out there and say, hey, I need to event storm this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
Cool.
All right. And then we've got the Ionic Vancouver at 6 p.m. over at Lighthouse Labs, 350 128 West Hastings.
Mm-hmm.
And what's Ionic all about?
I think it's basically a framework for iPhone and Android, and it uses Angular. So it's sort of like another version of, you know, React Native or...
I thought it was more like another version of PhoneGap.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I don't think it's writing native code, but I think you're right. It's more of a JavaScript-y sort of web-based version of that sort of thing. But it's the Google answer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, it looks pretty pretty cool.
Yeah.
And that's at 6 p.m. on Thursday.
And then we have the Vancouver Scala meetup.
And this is over at a different location this time. It had traditionally been at Hootsuite, I think.
Mm.
But now it's over at 938 West 8th Avenue. So a little bit down the street from there.
Yeah, Simba Technologies.
Yeah. And this is from 6 p.m. And it looks like there's a Scala-related meetup. And it looks like there's some talks this time. So there's talks on Spark streaming, dealing with state. And it looks like that's it. There's the 6 to 6:30 has got networking. 6:30 to 7:30 there's talk, and 7:30 to 8:00 networking and wrap. Looks like it'll be pretty fun. Spark is a pretty interesting thing, and this is over at Simba Technologies, 938 West 8th. Don't worry about bringing a laptop to that, but go and enjoy the networking and the talk.
Cool, and learn data science.
Yeah, so this is over at Bench, 353 Water Street. Oh, that's interesting. I thought Bench had moved to Pender.
Oh, really?
I thought they had, but I guess with this, 535 Water Street. Oh, they might have two places now.
I was
going to
say, maybe they have two. Yeah. They're pretty big now.
I think they have their developers.
Have you been to either Bench office then?
So I was at Unbounce when they were in the Pender location, and I believe the Bench moved in there after they moved.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Interesting. But this one is just the KO competition, and the topic is search relevance.
Okay, nice. And that sounds pretty awesome, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. So it's a Kaggle competition. Would you bring your laptop?
I probably would, just to keep those notes and maybe search things on the fly.
Nice. All right. And then what do you know? From 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., it looks like this is maybe an overlap with the Vancouver Scala. This is the Spark meetup at Simba Technologies. So I guess this is
it's both of the meetups.
Yeah. Cool. So it is Spark and it is Scala related.
Cool.
That should be pretty fun. And then we've got Friday the 17th, BCTIA Grub in the Hub has a lunch and learn And this is over at 887 Great Northern Way at the BCTIA Innovation Hub.
Yep.
And this looks pretty interesting. It says everything you need to know about equity crowdfunding.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're interested in that, make sure to go and check that out.
Be sure to register as well.
Oh, yeah. Be sure to register as well. You must register.
There's food as well. Pizza. So that's cool. Awesome. Get some nice lunch.
Yeah. And learn.
And learn. Yeah. And that's it for the meetups around town.
Hope to see you at some. Right, and we're here with our super special guest, Peter Thompson of Atlantic Fusion.
Yeah, we can go with that for now. Yeah, sure.
Go with that for now. All right, cool. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Peter? How long have you been in Vancouver, first of all?
I've been here for about just over a month now.
So pretty long time.
Yeah.
Pretty long time, yeah. For me, it can be in the last year. It's a long stretch. Yeah.
How long are you planning on staying?
Not really sure. I'm kind of a series of one-way plane tickets right now. So, yeah. But I do have to take off actually to Calgary next Saturday for about 3 weeks. But I'm looking at coming back. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Hopefully you do come back because that'll probably be pretty much the best time of year to be in Vancouver is right in the middle of summer.
For those
couple of months. Yeah. Nice. So what brings you to Calgary?
Calgary is actually a place I lived for before I lived in San Francisco, which I guess we'll talk about later. Lived there for about 6 years post school and kind of got my career life was a little bit more into the corporate world and realized I didn't want to continue doing that. but I've got basically my life in Canada is technically in Canada, Calgary still, even though I'm rarely there, but I have a wedding and some things to tighten up.
Awesome. Okay. So that sounds pretty cool. So, tell us a little bit about that. You said you kind of started out in the corporate world and decided to change into some other things. What were you doing in the corporate world?
Well, I guess once I got out of university, I first moved out to Calgary. I was in Toronto at the time with a buddy from school. We started up our company, which is Atlantic Fusion, became just me as he went on to some other things, but basically a tech consulting shell, try to figure out what we were doing, playing with ideas. And what I ended up doing mostly in Calgary was I just would get contract work doing project management and technical projects. First, I actually started Shaw Communications. Was my first kind of break into formal world.
That's a pretty big first client.
Well, I guess so. It's somewhat standard. They do a lot of IT does a lot of outsourcing to get different special skills and stuff. So I was part of a larger project team and servicing them. So
yeah,
it was a good first exposure for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I went from telecommunications, got into oil and gas, obviously, with that, you know, that in Calgary. I did my first official startup I worked for out there, which was doing a SharePoint play. It lasted about... 6 months officially. I think it's still kind of kicking around, but not in any kind of major official capacity. And then I also, fortunately, actually in Calgary, I fell into working in retail, IT retail at FGL Sports, formerly for Zanny Group, which is actually owned by Canadian Tire now. So I was there for their corporate takeover of that and working on one of their biggest projects at the time to upgrade all of their planning and logistics software and system. So
you said fortunately. Why fortunately?
Yeah. I think, first of all, I always just thought of retail as just being like, you know, I picture being in the store and I just didn't think of it as that great and exciting of a thing. I've kind of always had aspirational drives. I want to have, you know, driven by the movies, I guess, of where you're going to be taking over the world. But once I got into it, you really realized how complex it is and what's all going on. Plus, retail is actually... it opens up opportunities all over the world because it's everywhere. It's part of everything, really.
Right.
And I say fortunately because that led to an opportunity in San Francisco, which I got called up on. If it wasn't for me kind of deciding to take that one job, I wouldn't have ever gotten in. And then kind of realized this path, at least my fallback path, is available to me. And it's a pretty good fallback path. So
Right. So that's pretty awesome. So I guess you grew up in Toronto?
No, I grew up in rural Saskatchewan.
Oh, sweet.
yeah, you could say that. So I was there till I was about 17, and 2 days after graduating high school, I took off for a trip to Calgary and just never came home. So
nice. Yeah. That sounds pretty cool. So what was it like, I guess, as a Canadian, what's it like going down to San Francisco?
It's exciting. I guess the time I took off and I, you know, kind of went back to the Calgary thing and saying the corporate world wasn't really for me is I really just felt like I've always kind of been more of that, a little bit more creative and aspirational, kind of chasing more my gut instinct on things. And that's a lot of what drove my decisions and where I went to school and actually went overseas for a bit for exchange. And then did sort of what my parents, most of our parents had wanted us to do, right? And then I went to Calgary because the economy was booming in 2006.
Right.
Sort of went through and got those jobs that I did. And just realized that it wasn't a path that was going to take, you know, I was doing okay, but I just didn't, I wasn't meeting the kind of people that I really needed to kind of grow myself and really push the buck, I guess, forward. And I wanted to work on the creative, you know, future forward things. So decided I was leaving. For some reason, never really clued into Silicon Valley as being an option. And a friend from university was going to a conference out there. Called me up and I was like, hey, yeah, I'm just sort of looking for a place to go. San Francisco actually came on the radar because it was one of the top places in the world at the time, probably still is, for green tech, which I'm really into, sustainability. So popped out there and he sort of snuck me into one of these startup conferences. He was there for an app dev thing. Yeah, it was apparently a $700 ticket, although they weren't checking when people went in. So I guess if you're ever in San Francisco to show up
because everyone there is
see.
Rich, they assume they already bought it.
Yeah, pretty much. But once I got in there and it was just full of lots of like creative startup-minded people and I just seen what everybody's doing and it was just kind of like, it went off. It's like, why am I not doing this? Like, you know, everybody else is doing, like, why am I not here? So, yeah, and I think for me, and at the time anyways, it felt like that wasn't really an option in Canada, which, you know, I wouldn't say that now, but I think it's not as apparent. You don't have that critical mass of activity, and you're kind of in that place where there it's like everybody's focusing on that, and it's like people from all over the world, so you're just really in the best of it, so it kind of even validates that that's a valid thing to do with your life. So yeah, I picked up and just said I'm going to go, and you know, as Canadians, we can go down to the U.S. and visit or do biz dev for 6 months. So that was my goal, is I'm going to show up down there and plug in and see what happens. Worst case scenario, I come back to Calgary and look for a job. So. But 3 years later, I was still there, but no, it was great, especially moving to San Francisco as a Canadian, I think, like, it's just such a progressive, open city. Like, there's just all the things that we think we take dear and, you know, believe in, you know, universal healthcare and stuff like that. You can say that there and people won't, you won't get chased out of any places. So
I guess the weather's slightly better than Calgary, right?
Depends. In the summer, it's basically their winter. And the summer is cold. It's like, of course, it'd be funny because, like, people there would just assume in California that, like, Canada, it's permafrost.
Yeah, exactly. There's a moose in the highway. And
well, exactly. You know, so... but no, generally, yeah, it's pretty awesome. I love biking. I'm all about getting around on bikes and I'm very anti-car culture. So being able to do that yearly was, great.
So you're simpatico on everyone with the bikers with the new bike lanes and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, actually Vancouver is awesome that way. And just, you know, seeing more and more pop up. So as far as a green city and like, that's one thing Vancouver's always had my heart on is it's just like, it's just awesome livability that wise that way. So
well, that's another interesting thing. What do you think, what's your impression of Vancouver after having lived in San Francisco for so long coming up here?
Well, I'd visited Vancouver a lot before and I've always loved it as a place I wanted to be, but you know, especially when I was back in more of that corporate mindset that I have to go after these big jobs, and Vancouver traditionally, and at least in my investigation in that set, is, you know, in Calgary at the time anyways, you could make, like, it felt like, you know, you'd make 30 grand more than you would in the same job here. Plus there was just sort of more activity going on and it would cost you 30 grand more to live here. So at the time I couldn't really justify it in that mindset. It just didn't make sense. But you know, I love the urbanism, like, you know, the live and walk to everything. I never have to think about a car. So that was really awesome. But then, coming back after being in San Francisco, and one of my big things in coming here was, you know, wanting to sort of give, you know, look back in Canada again, give it a try. I've already kind of done this in Toronto back in September. And then Vancouver being the other option of, you know, what's the tech scene like here? And I knew that it's more social impacts really started to really grow here. There's a lot going on here. But yeah, I get a sense for that. And I've been pleasantly surprised. I was nervous that I would come here. And if I, you know, in moving here, if I decide to sort of rebase here. That I might be mentally cut off and, you know, kind of feel alone. But that I've gone to a few events. I've ran into you a few of them, obviously. That's what brought us here today. So, yeah, I feel like there's some good minds and some activity going on. And it seems like it's trending up. And definitely in the areas that I really care about, which is like sustainability, social impact, great things. And San Francisco's a short flight away. It's, now that I'm plugged into it, I feel like you don't really need to be there because I've kind of plugged into those people, made those connections. Validated that this is, people are actually making real money doing these things and doing quite well at times. So it's good.
That sounds quite interesting. So I've actually I came back to Vancouver 3 years ago, and I think, like, just in that time, in that the last 3 years, I think we've gone through a lot of really good growth. I think our community's really, I don't want to say it has matured a lot, but it has matured a lot over that time. We're still, I think, quite a young, a young tech community and kind of just budding, but interesting things are starting to happen.
Yeah, definitely.
I was going to say that I think that, both in a great way and in a terrible way, people don't notice necessarily anymore when you leave a city. Mm-hmm. Like, I left Ontario, and it was like people didn't even realize there because they just email me or text me or call me or whatever, and, hey, I got this project. Are you interested? And I would just call them or something. It doesn't really, I think, affect things anymore because that, you're right, that connection is there, and they're just going to leverage that no matter where you live.
Well, exactly.
Especially if you don't change your number.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. If you still use a phone.
Yeah.
Or a phone number.
Yeah, you don't move to rural Saskatchewan.
Time warp. I think, too, and especially in the space that we're all in, it's like people are traveling. We're all over the place. It's kind of, the world is very small now, you know, I think for everybody. So it's very much, like I've been in, last 9 months, I've probably been in almost a different place for each of those 9 months, mm-hmm. and people don't even realize I've left San Francisco at times in those 9 months. I've had somebody before I popped in here message me and say, hey, long time. Like, they think I'm still in San Francisco, but it's been a while.
You want to catch up?
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you were actually working on in San Francisco and what you're working on now?
Yeah, sure. So when I first went there, it was more to plug into that startup scene and really kind of just looking for those ideas and that thing that kind of sparked my interest to get involved in. So it was a really kind of, I believe in this idea, I guess, structured serendipity. You're just sort of throwing yourself out there to see what's going to happen and who you're going to meet. So that was the initial start. I ended up running into somebody who was actually a VC and had a fund, and he was having a bunch of his companies meet graduate students at Stanford. So I got invited as a special guest to show up as if I was one of these students. I didn't pretend that I was, but you know, I got to be amongst these people. You know, if people didn't ask, I didn't really say too much.
Right.
So that was really cool, and I actually got exposed to my first opportunity to start up and partnered with them. I actually did it through my company, Atlantic Fusion, as a consultant to them and helping drive some of their customer engagement stuff.
Nice.
That didn't last, you know, as you get into it, it was a startup. So, you know, lots of great lessons, great experience.
Yeah.
But it was about 5 or 6 months only of an opportunity. But then I left that and kind of went back out there, was sort of investigating a lot. Hadn't found civic tech yet, which I guess we're going to talk about, but sort of investigating that space and just different ideas. And then I actually got called up one day, going back to the retail connection, when I was kind of getting to my end where, because I basically have worked, you know, doing the corporates, paid for a lot of this opportunity to do for myself. Kind of running low on those funds again and wondering, oh, what am I going to do? And really not wanting to get a job. And then actually I got called from this agency, Tech Systems, which is somebody I've partnered with down at my company. They're an agency, essentially, but on an opportunity for what would become a client down there, Charlotte Russe. It's a smaller retail chain. Guess it'd be more equivalent, I think, to Forever 21 type thing in the States. But yeah, I got called by them to come and check out this thing. And I thought, well, I'd better, you know, maybe look at taking on a job if it's sitting there in front of me. Yeah. So I talked to them, but it was also nice because I had the confidence at the time where I was like, this is my rate and I'm not leaving this path of making no money unless I'm making this much money. So, which worked out well. So I got a really good opportunity to take on a project. America's a little bit behind in chip and pin technology. They're finally getting it. And they're only going with the chip. Pins will be later. I think they don't want to confuse anyone. But it was a project. They have about, this chain has about 500 stores across the U.S. They were upgrading to new chip and pin pin pads and also upgrading their POS system, so the operating system on their point of sales. So it was helping lead the development of software for the pin pad to the POS and rolling that out, and then rolling out new hardware and POS system to
Interesting. So what kind of POS systems, like what sort of software was involved in that?
They were running, it's Micros software is what they were running on, which is now Micros, you know, the big companies forever eating up smaller companies. So and gluing together messy code and putting a nice face or nice-ish face on it. So it was that. So I took out I finished that up in September. And that was about a year and a half project. And dove into a few other things. I'm really into collaboration automation of like productivity work. So like cloud software, moving to the cloud. So Microsoft has finally come a long ways there. Did a little bit of side stuff trying to push them to doing that. It didn't go too far, you know, cultural resistance and different things.
Right.
But that's what I was doing. And then after that, you know, I had some opportunities anyways to start, you know, the next steps were going to some little bit bigger retail chains, but decided that I needed to get off the corporate treadmill again and said, you know, try at least to go after that creative side of things and dove into the startup world. And I'd been in San Francisco for almost 3 years at that time. I thought, hey, I know the city pretty well. I found this thing online. A bunch of people were meeting at a beach house in Curacao, which is in the Caribbean, to co-work for a while. Nice. I was like, well, hey, that sounds like something I would do and I want to mess it up. So I took off to do that. So I left San Francisco, turned down any opportunities at making money. actually showed up. First, I started out, I wanted to go visit Toronto. I'm kind of on this path of, I believe in reflecting on where you've been before. You change as you go to these different places. And so I wanted to go back to Toronto and see what's the tech scene like there now. What is the scene? What do I think of Toronto now? Like, you know, it's one of those places like Vancouver that possibility, you know, that come back home. So I went out there.
And this is last September?
September, yeah. So went there, actually met a bunch of people in civic tech. You probably have crossed paths with a few of them out in Toronto. So Civic Tech TO, they're doing a lot of good things. Was happy to see that going on there. Went to some of the incubators out in Toronto and then was back and forth. Went to New York City for a couple of weeks as well, plugged into the scene there and kind of gave out a little mini trial of being there. And then, I took off to the Caribbean and lived out in the sun for a while. It was way too hot for me, but I had a pool to jump into. So it was really awesome. And then after that was off to Europe for another month and kind of thing. Kind of working all the way along, like hacking on things.
It sounds like you've got a pretty rough rough sort of time of it.
It's been quite tough. Lots of uncertainty.
So all of these places, I mean, San Francisco, New York, Toronto, Vancouver, Europe, I guess all over the place. What are your thoughts? Like, what would be some of the benefits, say? So for me, for example, as a Canadian living in Vancouver, would I or should I consider Toronto or San Francisco or New York?
It's really an individual question. It really depends. Like, for me, I think it was really important to kind of, you know, especially coming from my simpler life and exposure in Saskatchewan, where I didn't have I like telling people, or I do tell people to give perspective. I sent my first email when I was 20.
Right.
So, I'm not that old. So it kind of gives you, not that I didn't have some exposure to technology where I'm from, but I also had party lines, if you guys know what those are growing up. So it could be kind of,
I don't think so.
So party lines are, well, I was getting taught this. I did a comp sci slash business or BCom hybrid degree in university. And one of the classes was telecommunications. And the prof was talking about these things called party lines to the class. And what they are, well, I guess I'll to the story, but what party lines are first, he's saying, well, you guys have probably never heard of these from way back in the day when we didn't have like private phones to call each other on. We had to have like, you know, switch networks where certain neighborhoods had. Where I grew up, actually, my family was, I guess we were one of more of the privileged ones where I was from first to have a private line to our house. But I remember being on the phone when I was, I don't know how old I was, but Jackie Thompson, about same last name, but 3 miles down the road, I could hear a voice coming from the phone and she was screaming at me to get off the phone because I had picked it up and was screaming to my mom to call somebody else, but I hadn't checked first to see if the neighbors were on the phone. So
that's crazy.
So I have actually heard of that before. I used to work with someone from the Active State. I think he was from like Grand Forks or something. And I think they had the same sort of thing. They had the same.
Yeah.
It's like a neighborhood phone line?
But interestingly, I think they were also the first house to get their own private line.
Okay,
Everybody the same sort
of... So, it was really... And then I actually was going back to the class story. So he was talking about this. He's like, you guys have never ever seen these, but maybe in cottage country out in Toronto, they talk about the... I think it's was it Shuswap or Muskoka to them, I think. Anyways... You know, trying to talk about the old days from back in him. And he was quite a bit older than me talking to this. And I'm like, well, I've had a party line. And everybody's like, where are you from?
So where are you actually from?
So it's about an hour north. I don't know if you guys have been to Saskatchewan, but it's about 1 million people spread across a piece of land that would fit 1.5 Californias, which is a story I've used a lot down in San Francisco. But an hour north of Regina and maybe 2 hours southeast of Saskatoon, between a lot of trees. It's not like people that grow up in cities, even like Vancouver, where Burnaby's another place, but it's like you're crossing the street. Like, there's you're going to hit some deer on the way. There's fields. So a little town called Beaulieu, or a village actually called Beaulieu. It was about 100 people, and I was 10-minute drive from that. Through fields and deer.
I've been to
I have hit one on the way.
I've been to the Saskatoon International Airport.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because I guess it's international, right? Because they do international flights.
Yeah, maybe now. I'm not sure where. Oh, they must have found an airport that would accept them or do something.
Yeah, so Saskatoon Airport's the closest they've been to
Really fair enough. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, cool. So coming back to the where to live sort of thing.
Yeah, sorry. I don't even know what the right question is for me. That's part of all this traveling around. It's I'm kind of a big believer in kind of pushing your boundaries and taking yourself outside of your comfort zone and building your perspective. So I think that San Francisco definitely, if you're wanting to really plug into thinking big and maybe feeling comfortable with doing, because I think even here, and I think most people from cities anywhere outside of San Francisco, one of the common, so yeah, if you're in the startup scene, you're kind of minded that way. I think it's a great experience to really be amongst that ecosystem. Because one of the things that, you know, I'd commonly talk to people that were there, say, everybody be like, why are you here? Why are you here? And I would be, well, I'm basically here because here everybody understands why I'm here. Where everywhere else is like, what the heck, why are you going there? It's like the kind of the question of just sort of saying, you know, to explore and create, and that explains enough there. My parents, after, you know, knowing me for quite a while, still don't know what I do, so but there people get you in 2 seconds. Maybe for that reason.
So I think maybe that we Drew and I have talked to a couple of guests before about maybe you know, the difference between maybe Vancouver, Toronto, and San Francisco. Some people, I think we joked about an article that once called like Toronto or Vancouver, the Silicon Valley of the North or something like that. I was wondering if there was anything that you saw maybe in your past little travels and even spending 3 years in San Francisco, like maybe things that Vancouver could steal from these other cities that would make Vancouver a better place.
I guess, Vancouver's already stolen housing affordability. You can't afford to live in either city, so it's got that down. It's hard to say. Like, I think, you know, you can say that's fair, but Toronto and Vancouver being that for Canada, I think one of the challenges is, and it's not even fair to really compare, like, I don't know if Canada can really get like a Silicon Valley. I don't know if many other countries can. Like, you know, America itself is 300 million people. You know, Canada is just California, and we're spread quite, you know, far apart. So maybe even the critical masses that we have of people in Vancouver and Toronto, I'd have to look at the stats per capita. Maybe that's actually a really respectable amount of activity, or maybe it's greater than. The only thing that it's really missing, I would say, in both places is that critical mass of so many people. Like, you can't help everywhere you go in San Francisco, you run into somebody that's doing some crazy startup idea, and or people that have raised money doing, like, you know, raising $1.5 million there. Like, before I had gone there, I would never ever, like, sure, that'd be great, but you would never tell somebody you were trying to do that. Like, you're crazy. But there, it's like, you know, oh, that's all you're going for. You know, your idea is like maybe not that good. So actually, maybe that would be advice I would say to just Canadians, people anywhere, is kind of that confidence to realize that it's not crazy to think bigger. And I read a lot about that, even in the challenges in Vancouver and Toronto, more so I think Vancouver and a lot of other parts of Canada, is that VC funding culture of, you know, not really taking those chances. They'll invest in you after your Facebook. Like, you know, it's like, well, I don't need your money anymore.
Yeah, we talked about with Dean Sutton about, like, the Canadian politeness almost falls into business as well, where maybe they're not, Canadians aren't as aggressive as far as, like, I want to rule the world, which the U.S. is, and Canada's more like, I want to rule the lower mainland. They're just, like, they're too geographically stuck. They think about their neighborhood, not the world entirely.
Yeah, or they just want to go to the U.S. after. Maybe that'd be the biggest, I think, most of Canadian companies would think of. Like, and not that these aren't big ambitions to become those unicorns, you know, the $1 billion companies plus. But, to really think about, you know, especially if you're going after VC funding and, you know, maybe it doesn't resonate here. Unfortunately, it sounds like you still might have to go to the Valley or like-minded VCs to raise your funding. But to really think about that is like, you know, how does this become this, like, a world, how do we become a dominant global player in this? And it's okay to think like that. And it's okay to do that, starting small and regional, but you can have those ambitions. So,
So just to summarize, maybe you said population and VC availability might be the two.
You know
things.
What? Actually, the first thing that I would say is maybe the VC culture. And I can't say that because I've tried, this is just from my reading and talking to people. But it seems to be a pretty popular, you know, it seems to be a consensus around that. I think that that's actually the one thing that Canada can get on, and you know, maybe even the government. I think a lot has, there's some good things on, but I think more of a culture of this. Like, I think we're starting to talk more that way, but the government discussion, like the U.S. government's doing a lot, especially around civic tech.
Right. So that actually brings us quite well into civic tech. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your involvement with Civic Tech, how you got into it, and what you've been doing?
Yeah. So I guess in one of my random nights wandering San Francisco to different meetups, I stumbled in on Code for America's head offices down in San Francisco. And then there's the global branch Code for All, which some might just, I guess, to a Canadian audience kind of clarify, because it's not like Team America, Code for America.
Yeah.
These people are very minded about global society. It's not like American-centric, like rah-rah.
It's kind of interesting because we have like the Code for Canada Vancouver Brigade, which is the official Vancouver Brigade of Code for America.
Exactly.
So. I like brigades.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, the movement's definitely more of a global inclusive idea in that. But anyways... I basically stumbled in there and kind of discovered the thing that I've always been looking for. And again, lots of my life has been kind of chasing what's in my gut, but I didn't know what it was. And probably a lot of us feel that, especially in startup land, right? So wandered into this hack night one night, and you know, Code for America's head office is based in San Francisco, a very cool space, you know, lots of activity, obviously lots of smart people kind of all around doing, and San Francisco is really great for, like Vancouver, for social impact and nonprofit activity. So there's a lot of people that really care about doing good things, but kind of really pushing the bar and how we do that, new ways of doing it. So went there one night, and ever since then, I got really excited about what I was seeing and kind of crystallized for me where I needed to focus or wanted to invest a lot of my time, and got involved. Actually, they were just, ironically, San Francisco was just starting its brigade about, I think it started 3 years ago, but it didn't really take off. And then when I showed up, not that I was the reason.
So you were the catalyst. I mean, Code for America.
Yeah, but, but I really did join a few other people to help form the official first brigade core team.
Cool. Nice.
So yeah, I invested the first year helping get that going. Yeah. I left the core team after a year and invested some time doing projects and stuff like that. Still kind of connected to them, but you know, I left. Been traveling for 9 months, so I loosely actually remotely ran a project up until December for a nonprofit slash collaboration with the brigade there. But yeah, I really, through that, kind of cut my teeth, and you know, I've never done anything that was really deeply involved with working nonprofit or doing the volunteer stuff, which is a whole other dynamic, and it's honestly one of the toughest things I've ever done engaging, because there's great people that want to do great things, different skill sets. They're volunteering, but you want to get things done. So, like, can you fire a volunteer? All of us. But that was kind of, and then from there, it's opened up a whole other world. Like, civic tech is such a broad thing on its own, and it's, well, there's lots of debate, and even the term civic tech is debated if that's even the right way to call it, and if it's too exclusive and sounds too techy. And
yeah, what is civic tech?
Yeah, like, well, to me, I don't want to, you know, I want to preface this by saying the way I would define it, because there are some different purist views, I think, out there, and people that have been around the space for much longer and define it differently. To me, it is, you know, I would rather maybe even put it more in perspective of gov tech, because I don't, civic tech is sort of more of a city kind of mindset. It is local. But everything's, it's kind of bringing down to that grassroots of just our life together as people, as a society, is what I think it is. So I would almost see it as
social
tech, citizen tech, or social tech, or community tech.
Yeah.
Public tech.
I don't like that one, but But it's really about how do we, it's technology bringing us together more on that, just like, you know, social media has done for all of us, you know, and the fact that we can be in other cities and we're like still right beside each other. It's doing that with government, I think. And the one, Tim O'Reilly, who's got a lot of tie-ins with all of this kind of stuff. One thing he said, is, or put out there, is a notion of like, you know, government is a platform. You know, maybe another way of putting it is really government is an API. Like government as it exists now, and lots of bureaucracy is there because, well, we really need it. It was necessary evil. It's people trying to control information. We're only capable of doing so much. You got to silo stuff. But a lot of this, a lot of the stuff we have now doesn't need to be there anymore. And we can almost self-service ourselves in a lot of government. And a lot of these people working in government, honestly, they're capable of doing a lot more things that are more human-centric than, you know, going through their spreadsheets or having to follow a process that is just there. So I think civic tech is really disruption to traditional government.
So, what are some examples of civic tech that we might have that might make a difference?
Well, I guess your guest last week was one who I met with, Luke from Recollect. So he would be an example of a local company that's really sort of taking off and doing that. So just creating services that help citizens on their own, just service themselves, and, you know, so collecting their recycling. What do I do? How do I not forget that my garbage is coming out? Something simple like that. Or you've got, I think one of the key things leading up to this was the open data movement, which I think quite a few people are aware of. I would see that as kind of one of the seeds that planted a lot of this in the movement.
Right.
Vancouver is actually, I just recently learned through Luke, is the first city apparently to ever actually have an official open data policy. So that's pretty cool. Big props to Vancouver.
Awesome. That actually really is something good to know.
Yeah, definitely. So I would think that's there's just so many. I guess if I was to talk about things that are coming that are really exciting, and it was just actually in the paper yesterday, so a lot of people now have probably heard of or scared of the autonomous vehicles coming and computers taking over the world. And just maybe to talk about the different mindset that you have from even in the U.S. to Canada, and especially in San Francisco. So San Francisco, there's a open bid or a competition out right now from the U.S. government to integrate for cities to propose together to integrate autonomous vehicles with the Internet of Things, IoT, with transit systems.
Right.
Yeah.
Because really the movement is from a...
And I mean, you could privatize that pretty easily as well. I was just thinking of this yesterday. Conversation came up at work, and I was like, well, if you could afford a car, you buy a car, and you have it drive you where you want to go, and then you have it Uber itself out.
Exactly.
And then maybe you get another one if it's profitable, another one. And all you need is like a parking spot to charge your electric vehicle or whatever it is.
Absolutely. And that's
be able to afford, seven vehicles per parking spot because you have your charge time.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. The truth is too, a lot of like one thing right now that I really believe, and this isn't like public spending and infrastructure and planning.
Yeah.
Like these are huge projects, even which I'm pro transit. Mm-hmm. But I think even discussing these things and making big investments, we have to really think about the shifts that are coming, because like this is closer than I think a lot of people think. Yeah. And even building freeways and roads, which thankfully it sounds like Vancouver doesn't do anymore, and they're tearing down some freeways to put some parks, which is great. But making some of these big long-term investments, like city like in Calgary, it's still, they'll make big investments in these things
just to build off that. Like I've said this to somebody before, but just thinking about more about what Drew said about having like the cars or be part of your city, part of your actual job. But like I was talking to I think Gillian, like Why can't the government, even American government, U.S. government, or Canadian government, come up with something like React that Facebook came up with? They have a lot of problems. They have to serve, like the Canadian, like just the CRA website serves 30 million people. That's a huge problem. That's a big site. Like it's weird that they don't innovate a bit more, but also something like, why couldn't a city like Vancouver come up with something like Zipcar? Like imagine Zipcar was owned by the city of Vancouver. How amazing that would be and how profitable that would be for them. But it just seems like that innovation is kind of like scary almost. I'm not sure if you know how to like sort of make that shift.
They're coming up with the shared bicycles program.
They're privately owned, which is like, I guess it's great. They're probably running it a little bit more efficiently or something. But then there's like, it could be a city initiative as well.
It's a challenge everywhere. But some places more like it's a cultural thing for sure. But I think within government, like, even in San Francisco, although it's like leading the way in a lot of things with having like a chief innovation officer and just a whole department focused on this stuff. There's still a lot of bureaucratic stuff that's there, and I think it's just really tough because you got a populace that has preconceived notions. Like we're at the bleeding edge of things, and you're trying to change. I don't know. I think it's tough, and big corporations are bad at this.
Yeah.
It's not really fair just to say government. People are just doing their jobs a lot of times, and it's tough for – where is that going to come from?
Really, I guess, where the Code for America initiative comes from is exactly that. Mm. We see there's something that needs to happen. I think with a lot of this, I guess, the startup culture, and you have these small teams innovating really quickly, trying to get to that next round of investment, and, whether they do or not, right? That's really a make it or break it thing. But we've learned so many interesting lessons, I think, with tech. We've gone through, 10, 15 years ago, software development was quite the liability. And I think like the programmer wasn't considered an asset so much as today.
No, absolutely.
Now we're seeing like, wow, this is big value. Like what, do we really need managers? Do we really need these other middle people taking up space and preventing us from moving?
No offense to any of those people taking up space.
You're just taking up space. Well,
if that's what they're doing, right? A lot of the time in some of the larger corporations, that somebody's maybe a conduit of information and that's it.
Yeah,
and
no.
You could build out an API to do that. Right.
Exactly. And I just think it's institutional inertia, and it's not because they have to operate. Like even big companies, what you're seeing and what I think. So to answer the question on government, I do think it has to almost come from the outside, from organizations like Code for. I think government needs to support it, but almost funding these incubators. Mm-hmm. But it's the same happening in the private world. A lot of these big companies are terrible at this too. But a better way to innovate and less you know, to get rid of the red tape that you have to have because you need to keep your lights on.
Right.
Is their funding. They have incubators. And then they go out and acquire these startups. They let everybody fail on their own and have their fun. And then they find the successful one.
Right.
And they acquire these companies, which I'm going to assume without, you know, having hard data on it, they're probably doing – it's probably a lot cheaper than if they tried to do it themselves.
Right. It's way cheaper because they'd be doing all the R&D of all the failed companies as well.
Absolutely. Right? So I think what happens happen first in government, and again, I think the U.S. government and Code for America is really leading this, is probably a good example, at least for Canada to look to and model. The digital service in UK, I think, is also a very notable one. So I think those two places are probably the first places to look as a, you know, if you're a government.
So I think with the whole Code for All initiative, it's almost a little embarrassing how far behind we are in Vancouver and in Canada in general. And you said, you know, you kind of showed up on the San Francisco scene and boom, you were the catalyst for change and there was Code for America. So you're going to get us kickstarted at Code for Canada in Vancouver?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I thought you were for. You had your name on the Twitter handle. So.
That's right. But yeah, I've been trying, but you know, it's kind of interesting with some things. It's like it's really easy to get going. Like this podcast, for example, we kind of started it and we just kept going with it, and it picked up speed, and it kind of naturally grows.
Yeah.
With Code for Canada, I've been finding a lot of the time it's like rather than a little pile of sand, it's like a huge pile of sand, and trying to move that all by yourself it's a lot hard.
Yeah,
it's a lot harder than it might look, and so we are getting there. We've got a lot of the things that I've done with it have been kind of behind the scenes, like getting some connections with people in business and with government, and kind of building up to it. And we are looking to have kind of a kickoff hackathon actually pretty soon, and hopefully get things really going.
Cool.
So maybe you'll help out with that.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely down to help out. And that's kind of part of my thoughts here is take some of my learnings, you know, seeing from what's gone on in the States, and maybe I can do some good here. Because also, different political system in the States, that's a beast on its own to learn. And I can probably just stick with what I know in Canada and have a better impact.
Yeah, so just before we wrap up here, I know that most of our audience likes to hear it. What are some things about Vancouver that are just hands down better than any of the other cities you've been to?
Well, definitely for me, it's the green out. It's just a beautiful city. Like, it's honestly one of the best city. I've been to enough now. And I just had a friend who's traveled more of the world than me that was just here. He lives, we all met in San Francisco. So he was out here for a while. And he was like, he even said it's one of the top places he's ever visited. So I think it's an amazing place to live. I think being a creative person and stuff, to me anyways, I'm very, you know, visual. And so being around a space like this, being able to walk out every day, and it's amazing. Vancouver, not just geographically is beautiful, but the actual city. And I think there is actually a lot of progressive things going on here. And I think, and the tech scene is definitely, you know, coming from San Francisco, I will say, after a month here, I'm not scared of staying here. So, so I think that's a good thing.
Definitely. All right. Well, Peter Thompson, thank you very much for being on the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Awesome. Thank
you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Check out our website, vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Rate and subscribe on iTunes. Much appreciated.
You can follow us on Twitter, VanTechPodcast.
Feel free to leave some comments below.
You can also hit us up on the YVR Dev, the Vancouver Tech, the Van Tech Slacks. I'm at James.
And I'm at Drew. Special thanks to Same Room for hooking us up with an integration that allows us to have a cross-team Slack channel, VanDevs.
Do you have a meetup that you want us to plug? Email us, show@vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Music by A Shell in the Pit from the game Parkitect. See you at one of the meetups
around town.